Hello, this is Jeff Andrews. I'm in Piccadilly, at the offices of Drugstore Culture with Matthew D'Ancona, the editor of Drugstore Culture and a columnist and journalist, and the author of Post-Truth. Matt, can I start by asking you to define post-truth?
Well, I suppose the best definition of post-truth is as a phenomenon, really, where emotional response and emotional resonance matter more than facts and evidence in decision making and in political discourse. And that's something really that's arisen most obviously, most evidently in the years since 2016.
And why 2016 in particular?
Well, 2016 was a massively important year because we had first of all, the vote on Brexit, which was very much charged by claims of emotional resonance about immigration, about the NHS, and about the illusory prospect of Turkey joining the EU on the Leave side. And that really trumped Remain, whose arguments were very dry and very statistical. And the parallel to that was obviously President Trump's very unexpected victory. And I, for one, didn't expect that to happen. But what he managed to mobilize was what I would call a kind of brutal empathy. You know, he had a genius for attributing blame, finding fault with others, and for firing voters up without actually making policy prescriptions. And it was essentially importing the values of show business into politics. He was up against arguably one of the most credentialed and qualified candidates in presidential electoral history in Hillary Clinton. But that didn't seem to matter. What mattered was the emotional connection he made with a sufficiency of people at least to win the electoral college. And that was a milestone, I think, in this whole process.
Some people might say there were some developments before 2016. I'm thinking, for example, of, well, the election of Silvio Berlusconi in Italy or Tony Blair's defence of the Iraq war. But you're saying there's something fundamental in 2016.
Well, I think 2016 was the dramatic culmination of a long process. And I think you're right to identify the Iraq dossiers as a fundamental moment. I think what we saw was in the first, say, 15 years of the 21st century, a very dangerous and dramatic erosion of trust in traditional institutions. The Iraq dossiers were a very good example of that. So was the, obviously, the 2008-09 crash, which dramatically undercut trust in financial institutions. We saw the parliamentary expenses scandal. We saw the hacking scandal in the press. The BBC had all sorts of difficulties, and it seemed like dominoes that all the institutions that had, as it were, mediated trust were falling down. And I think that was a very important prelude to what happened in 2016. I think the other dramatic change was the development of digital technology. It's extraordinary to reflect that Facebook was only invented in 2004. And yet it and other social media platforms have swept the world in a very short space of time and also changed the way that we practice politics. And it has driven people into silos. The original promise of the web, to which I signed up, I freely admit, was that it would be a kind of political nirvana, that borders would melt, the tribes would speak unto one another, that it would be a kind of great unifier. And I still think, to some extent, it has that capacity. But what a lot of us missed, I think, is that it also encourages people to see more of the same, to look at more of the things that they already like. And the algorithms beneath social media do that. They give you more of the things that already fit your preconceptions. So, on the one hand, you had institutional trust decaying at a rate of knots, and a brand new and extraordinary technology that government really wasn't on top of, driving people into their political silos. And this was a very, very rich and fertile terrain for a certain new kind of politics.
So the far-reaching consequences here for liberal democracies in general, would you say?
Huge, because liberal democracy essentially has been baked into institutions. Since the Second World War, liberal democracy has found itself represented in a series of rule-based international and national structures, which we all are very familiar with and we all identify with. But what has emerged since the internet really became almost the dominant force in the world is that everything is now part of a network, or networks, plural. And liberal democracy has not yet found its place in that. It hasn't yet found a way of being kinetic and forceful and expressing itself with the kind of vigour that, say, the populist right has. And this is a real problem, because the basis of liberal democracy is we live in a pluralistic society in which various people have different incommensurable values, to use the old phrase, and they negotiate them using the institutions that are at hand. The digital world is one where anything goes and any voices can be amplified, and the shrill voices tend to be amplified and retweeted the most. So the rules of the game have changed fundamentally, and I think liberal democracy is struggling to keep pace with it. I think a allied problem is that we're now entering a world where a lot of people are of voting age who have not really seen liberal democracy at risk. So I'm old enough to have lived through the end of the Cold War, not the Second World War, but I remember vividly the battle between totalitarianism and the Free West. A lot of people are grown up now who don't remember that and have not seen liberal democracy imperiled. And so for that generation, it's not obvious that this is something that's necessarily precious, worth defending, vulnerable. And I think that's an added complexity to the problem.
You mentioned populism, and a lot of people would say that populism has been the doctrine that's risen since the global crash of 2007-2008. What is the relationship between populism and post-truth, would you say?
Well, populism I define as not being popular, but presenting or claiming that there are simple solutions to complex problems. So, for example, you say America has a problem with illegal immigration, let's build a wall. You say that Britain has a series of difficulties, let's get out of the European Union. These are big, broad brush strokes, and because of their simplicity and their boldness, they have natural appeal. The digital vectors that we now have make them easy to fire into people's news feeds with great effect. That sort of populism, I think, has had a tremendous surge, and I don't think that the liberal democratic component of the political spectrum has really found a way of answering it. Because by definition, liberal democracy depends upon a recognition of complexity, because reality is complex.
You mentioned the fall of the Berlin Wall and different generations having different political experiences and coming to politics in different ways. But I was wondering why people are still reading 1984, George Orwell's dystopian novel. And some, for example, have made connections between what sometimes happens on social media, on Twitter, echo chambers, and some of the language that is used in Big Brother. I wonder if that analogy works for you.
Well, I always tell undergraduates or people at school who are studying A-level politics, who ask what's the best book to read on politics, to start with 1984, because for me it's still the definitive text. It seems timeless. And there's a lot in it that's almost uncannily resonant at the moment. I mean, if you recall when Winston is being interrogated and tortured by O'Brien, O'Brien makes the point that there is no such independent thing as reality. There's what he says it is. If he says 2 + 2 = 5, it does. And he can force anyone to believe anything. So I think that resonates in the current environment, which is, you know, the slightly softer version of that is the Trump-eyed idea of alternative facts. You know, if you don't like this fact, you get some alternative ones. An interesting twist to the 1984 story is that the one thing I think Orwell got wrong was he said that repressive regimes would keep technology down. In the middle of the novel, when Winston's reading the Emmanuel Goldstein book, there's a section about how it was very important to the new order to keep technology very, very much under control. But in fact, what you're seeing is a much more complex interaction between new autocracies and the manipulation of technology. It's very striking how quickly the Russians saw the potential for this new technology to be useful in what the KGB used to call active measures. As early as the 1990s, even just after Yeltsin, people on the Russian side were starting to build up what became known as hacker farms, you know, ways of cyber attack, long before the West. And so I think that use of technology, the information warfare of the 21st century, has been, you know, an extremely important part of all this.
I was wondering what post-truth means for the future of political parties, which have traditionally drawn on political ideologies or philosophy to some extent. Does post-truth mean the end of ideology? I know we've been there in the past.
I think what post-truth has done is, as it were, undercut the tectonic plates beneath ideology and make it possible to say almost anything. You see this very much in the way the right describes Brexit. That now, all of a sudden, we have Jacob Rees-Mogg saying that the test of Brexit's success will be 50 years after the vote in 2016, whereas in the campaign we were repeatedly told that this was going to be a light switch solution to all of Britain's problems. And so I think you'll have continued statements of ideological fixity and certainty. I don't think that will change. But they'll actually be underpinned by a complete mobility. And what I think Trump represents more than anything is the complete vacuity of conviction. I mean, I genuinely think Trump would do or say anything that he thought would be in his interests. And the evidence to date is that he said exactly what he will do.
You're a political columnist, yes. Editor of Drugstore Culture. What does post-truth mean for you as a writer and a journalist?
Well, obviously, it's a huge threat. It was not a battle I anticipated that we'd have to fight, because I took it perhaps too complacently as an orthodoxy that we were all at least committed to the truth, even if we didn't necessarily agree on what it was. But that is gone, or at least it is imperiled. And so I think more than ever, the political commentator must be absolutely ruthlessly and uncompromisingly committed to finding out, first of all, what the facts of the matter are. And this is why I'm a big fan of the fact-checking organisations that have arisen, like Full Fact, because I think they're trying to come up with some solutions to what we can do practically about this. And I think that it's, you know, the commentators generally should be supportive of this. But what I think you have to be constantly aware of as a commentator is that it's no longer enough simply to assert the facts. You have to realise that we're now engaged in a battle of narratives. And therefore, the way that you present the evidence is almost as important as the evidence itself. The challenge has never been greater. I find myself quite surprised by the scale of the task. I'm absolutely up for it, but it's not a battle that I expected to be engaged in at this stage. I think that the truth of the matter is, if one is honest, that the so-called commentariat, or the liberal elite, or whatever you want to call it, did become a bit complacent, actually, and did take it for granted that their categories, their assumptions, their orthodoxies about the merits of globalisation, the proper role of the state, the wage gap, social integration, automation, a whole list of issues were sort of pretty much set in stone. And that, of course, is not the case at all. We live in a world of pulverising change, and we have to be more nimble and agile than ever before. And I think the one good thing to have come out of some very difficult and turbulent times, is that it has been a wake-up call. I think a lot of people involved in column writing have, without believing that they should appease bigotry, which absolutely they shouldn't, have perhaps expanded their horizons a little and gone back to first principles and asked what it is they're actually trying to do. And more than anything, what their job is, because that's the key. What's the job? The job is to provide good, well-sourced, well-reasoned and useful analysis for people in a civic culture. I mean, that's the job.
And how has your job as a journalist changed over the last 15 or 20 years?
I think it's broadened in scope. I started as a trainee on The Times in 1991. Here we are in 2018. When I started, the world was absolutely a world of institutions, parliament, parties, party conferences. That was how the world worked. You knew that here was the legislature, here was the executive, here was the civil service, here was number 10. Everything interlinked very smoothly, and you could identify the point on the chessboard where everything was happening. That's no longer true. To use the rather wonderful image used by Eric S. Raymond, who was a coder who wrote a book about the new society, quite a prophetic one, called The Cathedral and the Bazaar. We've moved from the cathedral of hierarchy and institution to the bazaar of a flattened democratic digital world in which you have to be very wily to know where the nodes of power are. And that's that's the job. The job has changed. Jobs do change. And it's lazy to assume otherwise. I mean, after all, you know, surgeons have to constantly update their knowledge on the basis of advances in medical technology. Why should journalistic commentators be any different?
And finally, you mentioned the liberal elite. I was just wondering, you know, the Brexit 52% and Trump supporters, whether they think all this post-truth is really an attempt by the liberal elite to escape from the realities.
I'm sure they do. I mean, there's a cringe sometimes by members of the so-called liberal elite, which is, we mustn't upset the 52% or, on the other side of the Atlantic, Trump voters. Well, I don't care about upsetting them. My job is to get to the facts of the matter. You know, I'm sorry if some people find the post-truth portmanteau word upsetting. I've no desire to upset anyone, but it's not going to stop me in my endeavours. And I also think that post-truth is useful because it's not actually about the right or the left. It's about how we get at the truth of the matter and how we move beyond a situation where a basic Enlightenment value, truth, is imperiled. Now, I think everyone who thinks for more than 2 minutes realises that it's in everyone's interests that we cling on to some notion of reality. I don't think it's an exclusively liberal task. And indeed, one of the interesting things is that a lot of the people who are engaged in this are people who've been associated with the right. I mean, David Frum, for example, in America, clearly a conservative, but would sign up, I suspect, to most of the things we've been discussing. So I don't actually see it as a liberal versus conservative battle. I think the populist right have been conspicuously the first beneficiaries of the post-truth era, but there's no intrinsic reason why it should be the populist right. It could just as easily be a populist left movement with very strong claims about the ability of the state to transform people's lives overnight. I mean, this is entirely possible.
Thank you, Matt.
Pleasure.